That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah. The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
When I go with friends, it's so funny because my friends are always like, oh, I don't want to go bowling with you. Like, Or, you know, when we do go bowling, everyone's like, oh, everyone's going to, you know, everyone try to beat Jack. And it's just like, that's. I'm going to sound like a major douchebag.
I like all your friends are the Hulk, by the way.
Everybody's the Hulk. Everybody's bigger than me and like large. Everyone's got their thing.
Hey gang, this is it. Episode 10 of Dexter New Blood just came out yesterday, and we are going to talk about it today. I am here with you, one of your co-hosts, Teddy Reed of Iron Lake. No, my name's David Magadoff, and with me as ever is my wonderful co-host and Dexter fanatic herself, Miss Claire Kramer. Hi, Claire.
Hi, David. Teddy, David. It was very nice to see you in this episode, which we'll talk about, but why don't you introduce our guest?
Well, we have a wonderful guest. We have a wonderful guest coming up later this episode. Yes, Harrison himself, Jack Alcott. You know him as, what did I just say? Harrison. He's going to talk about his love of bowling. But before we roll that ball down the lane, we have a very special guest. As you guys know, we've had on the wonderful creators of Dexter New Blood. Now we have the showrunner himself. Yes. A true mitzvah in our midst. This is Clyde Phillips. Hello, Clyde.
Hi, David. Hi, Claire. Hi, everybody.
Clyde, not only are you the showrunner, which, by the way, for in layman's terms means this is the person who is essentially the grand poobah. Let's be real, Clyde. You're the man, and it is a pleasure to have you on today.
Yes, thank you, David.
Thank you. I know this is going to be like the beginning of, I'm sure, a million interviews, or probably we're hitting you somewhere in the middle. I just really want to start out and say, like, what made this the right moment for Dexter New Blood and to bring Michael C. Hall back to the character that is so beloved? What made now the moment after, you know, so long?
Well, there had been a couple of attempts to try to put the show together, and they hadn't worked out. Really, what made this the time was that Michael was ready. This was 2.5 years ago. On July 1st, 2019, I got a call from Gary Levine, who's the president of Showtime and a dear friend of mine. And he said, I was on Martha's Vineyard at the time. And he said, I'm going to be in New York. You want to have lunch? I said, Gary, you've got two daughters who live in New York. You don't want to have lunch with me. So if this is business, let's just talk. And he said, okay, you're right. I'm busted. Michael's ready and he wants you and we want you. Can you come up with what the show would be and pitch it to Michael if you're interested? And I said, are you kidding me? Of course I'm interested. And I spent about, this is back in the days of Skype. I Skyped with my writing assistant in LA, and we banged it around and came up with the show. And then I flew to New York, pitched it to Michael. And Michael and I had stayed in contact all these years. Michael and Marcos and I are all friends. In fact, we used to live around the corner from each other when we were all in LA and we had barbecues every weekend. Any event, I pitched it to Michael. Halfway through the pitch, he stood up. He said, I love it. I'm in. Gave me a hug. Got back in the town car, going back to the airport. The whole thing took one day. And on the way back to the airport, I called Gary Levine, president of the network, who's a very busy guy, who snatched up the phone and said, well, and I said, Michael loves it. He's in. And Gary said, go hire a writing room. And now that doesn't mean go figure out the pilot, you know, that means we're making this show. Mm-hmm. So that's the impetus.
That's amazing. I mean, I was a huge fan of the original run, and I have to say, after you left, after season four, I was not as much of a fan. So when it was announced that you were coming back with Dexter, I think the components would have had to been you, Michael, and, you know, it was lucky that Jennifer Carpenter was available and able to come in and do the Harry role as Deb. You know,
and we jumped through a lot of hoops and had a very tough negotiation to get Marcos out of his contract at Warner Brothers. And thank God we did. I mean, he's
Marcos told me
director.
That story. It is. Yes. It is epic. I've never heard of more a story of someone trying to direct something that he's not allowed to direct and being wanted more by this crew that you guys were able to get him. It's amazing. So, Clyde, I'm going to go right to this. I remember being on set one day, and Marcos, I think, had a cut on his iPad of the death scene. And I was like, well, I gotta over the shoulder this moment and see how it looks. And I remember being like, I had chills.
And obviously, David, you're talking about the Dexter, Michael C. Hall, Jim Lindsay, Dexter Morgan death scene.
Yes.
There's a lot of death scenes in Dexter. Let's just get that clear. You were talking
this
about...
This is true. This is if you're
killing the main
this is the episode.
Yes,
this is the episode 10 recap. Harrison kills Dexter. Let's be real. Is there any other way that you were imagining? Because I've read all the interviews, Clyde, and we've talked. I know this was the inevitable thing, and I think it's cool. But I think a question that maybe hasn't been asked was the way in which Harrison killed Dexter, the way that we see it with the gun that Dexter gives him as a gift. Was this always the only way this was going to happen, or were there other ideas pitched around of like how Harrison was going to do it?
Well, there were other ideas pitched around. However, this was always going to be it because this is what I wanted to do. but I'd listened to my writing room intently and generously. And it's always best idea wins. And as far as I'm concerned, this remained the best idea. It's the concept of Chekhov's gun. Which is if you show a gun earlier in the act, it's going to be
never
used
put
later.
A loaded gun on stage that you're not going to shoot. Yeah,
sure.
Yeah,
sure. If there's a gun on the mantelpiece, it's going to be used. And it's also the whole concept. And part of it, I mean, I wrote this thing. I just watched it again the other night with my wife, and I was weeping.
It's beautiful.
A lot of this was written with blood in my pen. I had a terrible childhood. Years and years of therapy. I'm a healthy person. And that notwithstanding, there is the psychological concept of, in healthier terms, of the son needs to kill the father in order to get on with his life, whether it's in business or relationships or family or whatever it is. And that's all metaphorical, of course. And we did it literally.
Well, there was also the moment, and anyone who is like, you know, a real Dexter fanatic will notice it. Harrison says, like, look at what you've done. Look at what you've done, which is, of course, what Dexter says in season one, episode one.
Episode one,
before
yes.
Before his first kill, you know, and you're like,
open your eyes and look at what you've done.
Yeah. And it was like this great moment. I know for a long time, or at least, you know, it's been publicized that you wanted to have Dexter atone for his sins. That was definitely the ending. But in the father-son way, to me as a viewer, was sort of a new concept that was introduced this season. Because for a long time, I think, and you teased this a little in the finale, you know, Dexter goes to death row, or Dexter is in prison, and Dexter has to, you know, atone there. Was there ever a time before you developed the Harrison character and the sort of like triangulation of father-son relationships for Dexter New Blood that you entertained that idea?
Well, no, I had already spewed that idea out at the end of episode 8 to Entertainment Weekly, which was picked up all over the internet because people so disliked the season 8 finale. So I wasn't going to do something that was expected. And let's be clear, how many shows get a second chance at doing a finale?
Nobody, you know, never.
Nobody, yeah, nobody ever, as far as I know. And I also wasn't going to have him wake up in bed with Suzanne Plachette next to him, you know, for anybody in the audience that's over 20. And I just wanted it to be authentic. I mean, Dexter realizes that all of these innocent people, after they open your eyes, look at what you've done. All of these innocent people are dead because he does what he does. He also realizes, you know what? Damn it. I am a villain. I am a psychopath. As much as I try to be a human being, I can't. And then he says that line that just, well, a couple of lines at the final scene that kill me, when he says, "With I want to be a better man and I want to be a better father with your help." And Harrison says, "I'm not your goddamn caretaker." It's because Harrison's basically talking to an addict.
Yeah.
And I've had that conversation with my own father, who was a gambling addict, and kind of in the low-level Jewish mob in Boston, which is basically why we're here right now, because we got thrown out of Boston by the mob and I ended up in L.A. I could have ended up in Nebraska or Utah or been a tax attorney in Austin, Texas or something.
When's that show going to happen, Clyde?
Yeah, right. I know.
Really?
It comes out
I'm watching.
It comes out in everything I write.
There you go.
I mean, look at the, yeah, it's all in the, it's all Easter eggs in this about that stuff. I mean, it comes out in my books. I write mystery novels. And
with the exploration, obviously, as everyone can see, there was the father-son triangulation between, you know, Clancy and his son and Dexter and Harrison, and then the
Clancy and Harrison. Yes.
Relation, you know, everything was triangulated so nicely. Was this a therapeutic season for you to get out? Like, not necessarily, as you said, you've had years of therapy, you're done processing your own stuff, but can you put away that relationship, or will you in your writing continue to explore that dynamic between father and son?
I will continue to explore it. I mean, it's in my marrow. It's in my internal ecosystem. And, you know, just as because I had such a terrible father, and I was born when my mother was 17, so she didn't like me either, that I think that it has made me a better father, and perhaps even a good father. You know, as you know, the last episode is called Sins of the Father. And I wrote my wife a note when she told me she was pregnant with a little Tiffany baby spoon. That said, the sins of the father stop with me.
I love that.
And I've tried to be a great dad to my great daughter.
That's awesome.
So what was that final moment with Michael C. Hall? Like, you know, I mean, the moment that really touched me is when he like did this hand gesture over showing Harrison where to shoot. And I'm not sure he said anything after that. He was just like, here.
Well, before that, he said, take the safety off.
Yeah, like remember, son, like I told you. Yeah.
Yes, and which means I'm giving you permission to do that. It was a very interesting day, and we shot that scene very early in the schedule. We shot that in February. So we were always chasing weather. Whenever it snowed, we ran there. And I remember we were shooting at the veterinarian's place, and also that scene where Dexter chases a sheep out of a pen. That was all the same house. And we wanted to get a very serious scene between Jack and Michael down on film and get those two working together. So we gave up some snow and shot the therapy scene there before we shot the shooting scene.
Clyde, Marco said that was his favorite scene in anything he's ever done in Dexter.
The therapy scene? Yeah, it was amazing. And Scott wrote that. The actors, I mean, basically, it was he gave Jack a chance to go to masterclass, because Michael's such a generous actor, and Jack's a great actor, and the two of them really bonded. And then now that we had this serious scene out of the way because it was so early in the schedule, that was a Friday. Saturday we went to the studios, and because of COVID, we couldn't all be in my office, so we cleaned out the bullpen where all the cubicles are, and we rehearsed it as if we were out in the field. And for some reason, I have a baseball bat in my office. And we used that as the rifle prop. Huh. And we played the scene out, just, you know, first, you know, we just talked it through. And then they got up and put it on its feet, had questions, had suggestions, and got it down. And then the following Monday is when we shot the scene. So we had the therapy scene, the rehearsal, and then the scene. So what it was like to shoot the scene, to get back to your question, it was somber. It was a little bit sacred. The crew, many of whom just really didn't know the show, knew that something important was going on and were very respectful of it. And then there were a number of conversations we still had on the day about, well, what if I do this and what about that? And, you know, I worked with them on that and worked with Marcos on that. And then we had a discussion about how does Dexter fall once he's shot? You know, we wanted to avoid the Christ-like thing. We want to avoid the angel thing. And then Michael just had this idea. He says, you know, once I'm shot, basically my brain is disconnected from my body. So I'm just going to fall. And he fell. And if you remember, he kind of fell a little bit on his side mm-hmm. with one leg over the other. And he had to be comfortable because we did a shit ton of coverage and he had to lie there. And all that blood is I don't know if you know, is visual effects. That wasn't blood getting squirted out there by special effects. We added all that blood later in post.
He's just lying there in snow with a little sweater on him. That's cold.
Yeah, yeah. And then and we had to keep him in that position because, you know, Angela shows up and all this other stuff shows up. But at the end of the scene, Michael called across the set, which I'll never forget. He said to me, "Yo, Clyde, great words, man. I mean, come on. You know, I mean, there's redemption just in that."
Yeah. Yeah. Was there ever a thought of, with all the knives, possibly Harrison using a knife? I mean, I know that would be so intimate, but at the same time, did it even cross your mind to use a different utensil other than the gun?
It did cross our minds as we figured out how it was going to happen. We talked about knives. We talked about various other ways of taking Dexter out. But we kept coming back to the gun and the fact that, if this hadn't taken place in rural New York, maybe a rifle wouldn't be an issue because who gives a kid a rifle, in Miami or in in L.A.?
I like that it went from, knives have been prevalent the whole series, you know, so I really like that it took a turn and finished in a different way. And there was, mm-hmm. Because he was a different, at the end, the last 15 minutes, he was a different Dexter. Like that, the moment with Logan, that was unexpected to me. Logan's a good person. Logan did not fit the code. The character, I think, started breaking down, becoming less code driven and more humanistic in a way.
Well, he becomes his most
human. It's Harrison.
Yes, he becomes his most human in that final mm-hmm. scene. Pardon my interruption.
Yes.
In that final scene where his voiceover says, "I've never felt real love until now."
Mm-hmm.
I mean, early on in the show, Dexter said, "My sister Deb, if I were capable of love, she'd be the one." But he was always faking it. And in this moment, in this final scene, he's not faking it. He is sacrificing himself. The words that come out in the letter as Harrison's driving away, I could cry right now thinking about them. You know, if Harrison shows any dark tendencies, or if he doesn't, "Let me die so that my son can live." I mean, that's what a parent does. And that's real emotion. And that's very rare for Dexter.
Well, I thought it was beautifully done, Clyde, both your episodes that you had your hands the most in, which I know was episode one and this final episode. Before we wrap up here, is there a moment or a scene or something of the last 10 episodes that stick out to you, and any of the other episodes that just after watching them, you were like, "Ah, look at that. You know what? That turned out really fun." Or like, "Ooh, that was weird."
Well, I really loved the opening of 9 that Scott wrote in Miami with Mr. Wiggles.
Yeah.
I think that was terrific. I also loved the wrestling scene. I forgot which episode that's in, because I remember 6 being there and there were so many, we had hundreds of extras or as many as we could have with COVID. And I remember watching Marcos come onto the set. Marcos is always so prepared, right? And he's so strong and he's the loveliest guy in the world all at the same time. And I remember him coming onto the scene and the wrestlers were fucking around and Marcos basically, including Jack, just yelled at them. And he said, "This is going to be a long, tough fucking 12-hour day and I got 100 things I got to do with 100 people, so no fucking around. Everybody pay attention." And I was really, really impressed with that. And the scene turned out magnificent.
Yeah.
And also Clancy's stuff. Clancy, we could not have gotten luckier than to be able to land him and his... First of all, he is a person, as you know, is the greatest guy you want to hang around with.
So kind.
Yeah, lovely guy. In fact, he and I have a history. I've known him for decades. When he turns out to be the bad guy, when we see him, first with the girls and then with Harrison, those are just amazing, threatening moments. Another scene I love which I will confess to having had a hand in its creation, was the baseball scene.
Yeah.
The baseball batting cage scene. And that was really about Harrison not being able to capture joy in his life. And that was an issue of mine when I was younger. And so he says, "Oop, this is successful. I'm hitting the ball well. Up, the curveballs are hitting me in the side again, 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 again." That's self-flagellation. I thought, and Harrison did a great job, and Clancy was so evil in that scene and was taking such pleasure in hurting this kid. So that's it. I mean, it was just a great run. It was a great season and the hardest thing I've ever done.
Well, to do it all was just you and Scott were the only two writers there the entire time. You were away from your family for 6 months. You're wrapped up. I mean, for those who weren't there, Clyde Phillips, you never saw his face. It was just his eyes the whole time. He was goggled and everything.
Ski goggles and a gator.
But you did a masterful job of navigating this this incredible ship. So thank you for
I should also mention Bill Carraro, our line producer, mm-hmm. line executive producer, who just made the impossible possible all the time and kept a lot of problems away from me. You know, as you know, out at where the cabin was, there was a thaw. The lake thawed, the snow melted. Bill got a road crew out there over a weekend and built new roads for all of us so that we could actually make the show happen.
Oh, yeah. There was like a whole mud time. Like it was.
Yeah,
just,
it was World War I trenches.
It really was.
And then COVID. You know, we shot this show during COVID, 250 people, and nobody got sick.
Nope.
We were tested six times a week. And if we want to be in what's called Zone A, so we can be near the actors, because the actors are not wearing masks, of course, then we have to be tested multiple times. We all stayed healthy. It's just unfortunate that all the publicity photos show me in a mask and Michael Hall smiling, you know.
You're smiling underneath. We feel the smile.
Yes. Okay.
Through the mask.
On the inside, yes.
On the inside. Claire, Clyde, this is wonderful. So I think we need to move on to the man of the moment who is taking on whatever might be in the future. If there is something, Gary Levine, I hope you hear us. So Harrison, we have on today, Jack Alcott, who, of course, you know Jack from The Good Lord Bird, also on Showtime. But guys, you definitely know him now from Dexter New Blood. He's Dexter's son, by the way. Clyde, thank you so much for being here. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for going down the road of bringing Michael back and having these conversations and
doing
all that. And for hiring my mustache. I appreciate that as well.
Well, you only did it because of Sarah.
Yeah, she's pretty great. She's pretty great.
Yeah.
Clyde, before we go to Jack here and this wonderful conversation, any words on Mr. Alcott himself?
Well, first of all, give him my love. we were so lucky to get him. We knew the moment we saw him. I'd watched all of Good Lord Bird, and we pursued him pretty hard. And he's a great actor, a great guy, was always training. He trained for baseball. He trained for wrestling. He trained for stunt fighting, trained for kissing Audrey. He would always elevate the set. I mean, he was always in a great – he was like a puppy. I mean, he was always in a great mood, always running around, fucking around. And he's very agile. Both as an actor and as an athletic young man, I miss him.
He's a pretty great guy, and I think you all will enjoy how great he is right now.
Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number smart beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night.
And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Well, Jack, here we are, both in our closets in the middle of nowhere, Massachusetts, and Claire in a beautiful studio. Welcome to our show today.
Welcome to Fanatics.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for joining us. David has spoken so highly of you, and I love to have people that David knows and loves. And you love bowling. That's what we're talking about today.
I do love bowling. I do. I love it a lot. It's been a while. I've loved it since I was very little. It's sad. While we're in Massachusetts, I haven't really been able to recently, since the entire time I've been here because of all the sort of the COVID protocols and not going into public spaces. And I'm vaccinated now, so I think technically I probably could, but I didn't bring any of my bowling balls with me, which I've done on other projects. So I didn't bring my equipment, so I haven't gone yet.
All right, let's start there. What consists of bowling equipment? Obviously the ball.
Mm-hmm.
A ball bag.
Yeah, what's at home? When you say like balls, like what, like sitting at home right now is what?
Sitting at home, there are multiple bags. It's probably seven bowling balls I have, I think.
Wow.
That I've accumulated over the years. I've been doing it since I was probably 10 or 11. Just started as a fun thing and turned into something else. But it's your ball, your bag, your shoes. Sometimes people have multiple shoes, or you'll have a shoe that has different bottoms that you can put on the shoe so that you slide differently. Oh. On the approach of the lane. So if it helps your follow through, you want a stickier shoe, you want a slipperier shoe. There's that. There's all sorts of stuff that can go on the ball, like things that affect how it reacts to the lane. There's stuff for your hands and your fingers depending on how you throw. Like if I was like a total like bowling gearhead, the amount of equipment you can have, like, it's absurd. I don't tend to carry a ton. I just am like the ball, the bag, the shoes. And like a towel to wipe the ball off is usually
what. You have seven bowling balls, Jack. I was not prepared for that. I really thought you were going to say three tops. And I was, even that to me was like, wow, he really likes bowling. Why do you have seven? How does seven get accumulated? And I'm like flabbergasted.
Different weights, right? Different weights, different like
finger
holes.
Yeah, do they
have
names?
Yep. Each bowling ball that you get, it's always drilled. They measure every part of your hand and your fingers, and every bowling ball is drilled exactly to your hand. And so, starting at 11, my hand was a little smaller then. So there's that aspect of it, but there's also, and then there's weights. My very first bowling ball was 11 pounds.
Okay.
Yeah. I believe I was 11 because I remember that meeting. I was like, oh, it's 11 pounds. I'm 11. And then, bowling balls go all the way up to 16 pounds. That's the heaviest. Most people throw 15 pound bowling balls. I'm not really sure why, but like on the pro circuit, it's very rarely is someone throwing a 16 pound ball for whatever reason. I think 15 is the maximum weight. You can throw it hard, but it also has all the momentum and the carry and, pins go boom.
Is that the sound they make?
Yes. They go boom like that.
Nice. I can hear the sound though. It's like I can literally hear the sound of the pins going and then the thing coming down.
The technical
Isn't
term.
That funny? That's
exactly
sense memory right there.
Yeah.
Okay, so 11 pound ball. Now do you bowl with a 15 pound ball now?
I bowl a 15 pound ball. I also bowl very weird, and I'll get into that when we talk more about like how I got started. But yeah, each bowling ball, they not only
are there different weights, but there will be different weights inside of the ball. Like there are things that, that affect how it rotates. So there'll, you know, if you were to cut a bowling ball in half, just like a bowling ball that you'd find like in a bowling alley, it's just one of the ones you pick up. It would just be plastic or it would be hollow. There's nothing in there. If you were to like take, you know, take a ball from somebody who, you know, bought it and it's and uses it for their stuff, and you were to cut that in half, there's like a weight inside of it. And maybe the weight's a square. Maybe it's like, looks like a disc. Maybe the amount of like weird shapes that you'll find like inside a bowling ball, it's pretty, it affects the axis of rotation when you're throwing a ball. And so, but I couldn't tell you how the different shapes affect what, but, that, and then each ball has a different cover stock. So just like the material that it's made of, there's plastic, there's urethane, polyurethane, but so they just grip the lane different. So something that's kind of rougher, obviously, if I spin it really hard, it's going to grab the lane and curve really hard as opposed to like a plastic ball. So that I have lots of different balls that have different weights inside, that have different cover stocks, that also have, you know, are measured differently because my hand grew as I got older, but that's why I have seven. I probably use like three.
I was gonna say about three now. Yeah. Okay, wait. So we all know about what makes, you know, a football illegal in playing in the Super Bowl or, you know, some of these other sport equipment things. What makes a bowling ball illegal? Like, what do you do to the bowling ball so that it's not regulation and you technically should not be bowling with it?
This actually just came up for me recently because they added a new rule about how many holes can be in the ball, because there used to be a thing where like people would like drill extra holes into the ball, like at a spot that like maybe your fingers totally don't go there. Like your fingers are, you know, in the front and, you know, then extra large hole is like drilled on the side or on the back or, and that in itself also can really affect the way the ball rotates or grabs the lane. And you could really, and you know, you if you were to buy a used ball, you might, it might like have like polka dots on it that are holes that were filled, which is very weird. But so there's a new rule, the PBA, the Professional Bowling Association.
Professional Bowling Association.
I feel like it's an association.
I bowled a little bit too. I only had one ball, but it was a good one.
Don't spread that around, David.
Good Claire.
There's a new rule that's like, there cannot be any holes in your ball that your fingers or thumb don't go into.
Oh. Mm.
So that's a big one now, which also most of my bowling balls have three finger holes. The thing is, I throw two-handed and I don't put my thumb in the ball.
What?
And so all of my old balls, I can't throw anymore. If I were to get back into any pro or semi-pro stuff, which I, you know, I don't have any plans to do, but you know, if I were, I'd need to get a whole new set of bowling balls that only had the two finger holes.
So the approach is I bowl a two-handed approach. I am not a professional bowler. I just enjoy bowling, but then I release and go back in one hand. So how do you do two hands? Are you releasing with two hands?
Pretty much.
Or are you backswinging with two hands and then releasing with one?
The most important part for the two hands is the backswing and just keeping me from injuring everyone behind me. But yes, I do release with two hands, and it allows me to get more of a spin on the ball. Like I torque the living crap out of the ball. You know, as a kid, when I threw slower, like I would line up all the way on the left side of the lane and I would throw towards the right gutter. Like I'd throw across the lane and it would float out. It would be about to go in the gutter and then it would snap back into the middle.
Well, that's what I see professional bowlers do. Like I grew up in New Jersey doing high school bowling league just for kicks, nothing nearly professional like you. And I never bowled the correct way. I always just try to do my best to kind of get it straight down the lane. But no, every good professional bowler does exactly what you're doing. Okay, how did you get into all this? I have so many more questions because I did not expect. We've talked about, you know, I was mentioning like, hey, let's do this podcast. And you're like, yeah, let's do bowling. I grew up doing bowling. This is already, I'm 100% more surprised at the level and depth of your bowlingness, and it makes me very happy. How did it all begin? What's your bowling origin story?
What's your origin story? Yes.
My bowling origin story is maybe this is just people I knew, or maybe it's just a Tennessee thing. I'm from Nashville. You know, like little boys just went bowling with their dads. Like, that was a thing that, like, I did frequently as a little kid. And, like, my friends did it too. And, like, it's not like we would all go in a group, but, like, every now and then, like, oh, I went bowling with my dad. And I would go bowling with my dad. And, you know, like, with the bumpers up. And the, you know, it was just a fun thing we did. And my brother would come, and it was great. And I remember one day I saw this kid who looked my age or a little younger. So, you know, he was probably 9, and he had his own bowling ball, and I'd never seen that before. And I was like, whoa, it's like shiny. Like,
it was extra shiny.
It was extra shiny. It wasn't dirty and gross, like, you know, the balls you find in a bowling alley. I was like, oh, that's like got colors and stuff. Like, wow. And he picked it up and he held it with two hands and then just sort of like flung it with two hands, and it was spinning really fast and he got a strike. And I was like, like, I've never seen, like, what is this sorcery? Like, I've never seen this before. And I was like, oh, I'm gonna do that. I'm gonna try that. And I picked up a bowling ball and I just sort of like chunked it down the lane with two hands and just happened to get a strike. It was like, oh, bowling's easy.
So you can credit this random nine-year-old with your two-hand form for the rest of your life.
Yes. Exactly.
And then how did you get, so did you start bowling more often and did you join a league at that age?
That's exactly right. I started bowling more often because it was like, oh, this is kind of fun. And my dad enjoyed going with me. And so we would go all the time. And then we joined like a father-son, like Saturday morning league.
That's cute.
And then, and of course, who I end up running into in that league. And then eventually years later, playing on the same team is the kid who I saw bowling. His name was Will.
That is so funny.
And he was very good. And we bowled the same way. Which was neat. But yeah, so I bowled every Saturday and then sometimes for fun during the week, but I bowled every Saturday with my dad. And then when my brother was old enough, he joined us and did this sort of youth league, but and a father-son league. And then that turned into another league that was like a little bit more of a competitive youth league. And somewhere around there, like I started high school, I believe as an eighth grader, I started bowling for my high school's bowling team like a year early, which was really, really fun because you know, most high school bowling.
Yeah, you bowled up.
Yes, and not because I was like a prodigy, but because like our bowling team sucked.
I love that you had a junior high bowling team though.
No, we didn't have a junior high bowling team. We didn't have a junior high bowling team.
Oh,
I in junior high bowled in the high school bowling team.
Oh, yes. Okay, I'm following now. Okay, I'm with you guys
because they were terrible. I mean, there were some really good bowlers on the team, but as a
you
team,
you were a ringer.
Garbage. Yeah, and I was pretty okay at that point. And then I bowled all through high school, and that was when I bowled the most because, you know, when there wasn't a match, we still had practice and we had that like every day. And so I was in the bowling alley all the time and did
that
all
through
high school.
What was the scores that were happening, you know, like were they in the 200s pretty consistently? Like
I think probably towards the beginning of high school my average was the high 180s into the 190s, and then once later in high school, I was the low 200s, and then my most recent like sanctioned average that I can remember is 224. I'm definitely not at that level. Like if I were to go bowl right now, it would not look like that. But
best score, quick. What was the best score you ever had?
Perfect game.
Wow.
How many times?
Only once. I've gotten close many times.
Tell us about that game. Like as frame by frame, as you're going through and you're like, okay, that's another carryover. Okay, that's another strike. I'm still care. What was going on in your mind?
It was like me as hard as I can going, don't think about it. Don't think about it. Don't think about it. Don't think about it. Because every time I do that, I get in my own head. Because I mean, it's such a mental game because when it comes down to it, once you figure out how to throw a strike, it's just about consistency and repeating exactly what you did the last time. And as the game goes on, very slowly making these infinitesimally tiny adjustments as the oil on the lane breaks down, because lanes are oiled in different patterns and, you know, which is a whole other thing. But no, that day I remember, you know, it's like stringing like six strikes together was not a new thing. That was like, yeah, that was great. Woo-hoo. And then, you know, six becomes eight, which becomes nine, and it's like, I've bowled, man, I think the highest number of strikes ever bowled in a row is probably 14 or 15, but it was always across two games. So neither of them was ever
right.
A perfect game.
It didn't connect. Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Was this in a tournament or was it like a friendly game, a game with your dad?
This was in just like a friendly game with friends. And by the time I was at the end of the game, like half of the bowling alley had like had migrated to my to my table. And I'm just like sweating because it's like I'm bowling for fun. This shouldn't be nerve wracking at all. But I'm now there's everyone's watching and like I'm trying not to think about it or look at the people who are watching.
Are your friends saying things to you or are they like dead silent?
I think, yes, somebody definitely was like, don't mess up. And I was like, shut the fuck up. Like, don't do that right now. Like, now is not the time. I've never done this before. Let me screw myself up. If I screw it up, let it be my fault.
Like, so what is your mental preparation each time you, and obviously this perfect game, you know, is an example, but maybe not the best example because you weren't in a tournament. What's your mm-hmm. mental preparation each time before you go to actually bowl? Like physically bowl, you know, each frame?
I mean, really, for me, honestly, this is a good question because this is always really different for different bowlers. And it in high school was the most fun and also infuriating part of the game was evaluating your mental game versus your opponent's mental game and how can you use that or take advantage of that. And for me, it really has just always been like, just stop thinking about it, dude. Like, just breathe and just throw the ball. Like, you know what you're doing. You've been doing this for a gazillion years. Just throw the ball. Like, I know where I'm aiming. Most of it's just all muscle memory and not overanalyzing or talking. I'm going to go three boards.
Do you stare down your opponent ever give him like little him or her side glances?
Or like... I was a little bit of a terror in my like high school bowling circuit, and not in a good way, because I mean, I'm an actor and I was doing that in high school as well. And so I was doing lots of things, but I really enjoyed bowling and I always was doing that as well, but it wasn't what I was spending all of my time on. And one of my favorite things, and it's one of the most interesting things about, I think, the sport of bowling is the people that the sport attracts, whether it's in high school or you're an adult. Like, but you know, for example, in high school, it's like, what groups of people decide that early, this is my thing, like bowling. And within that, there are all these different types of people. There's like bowling jocks who are like, yeah, I've been bowling since I was 4. And I'm like, you know, I'm hot shit. And I'm like really good at bowling. And it's like, I've got 12 bowling balls. And they're very like, kind of like bowling jocks. And then there are like, bowling nerds who are like really, they're equally good, but they can't talk to people. Their like confidence is it's just somewhere else. It's like they can only engage with the ball and the pins, and it's like they're talking to themselves as they walk back from the approach. I'm going to move three boards left. I'm going to pull the release. I'm going to go back. And it's creepy almost. Like, and then there are people in high school who are, it's like, you know, oh, well, I don't really feel like I fit in anywhere else. And this is where I found my community. And then that's a whole nother world of people that is cool to interact with. But
so who were you? Which one were you? Which table did you sit at it? Or which lane were you in, dare I say, that metaphor?
I was the guy who was just like, I would generally was that, or tried to be. I did not always succeed. Was the guy who was like, I'm here to have a good time. Let's bowl some bowling. Let's go throw the pins at the ball. You know, like and that often was disarming to people in the really hardcore setting. Like, you know, on a normal match where it's like, you know, it's our team versus the other school's team, everybody's having a fun time, and you know, there's some room for dicking around, and you know, and we all knew each other and it was great. But you get to like a tournament, you get to the state tournament, you get to you get to some other sort of individual youth tournament, and it's like nobody talks to each other. Like, it's almost like do these people hate each other? Like, it's very intense. And I was known for not being that way. If I had an opponent who I felt like had maybe a weaker mental game, someone who like could be thrown off, because you know, you never want to be like, hey, don't mess up, guy. Like, I don't want to be rude. That's just poor sportsmanship. But what I would do is if I were to be
cough. You
know, oh no. No, I don't, hopefully I've never done that while someone's bowling, but while I you know, if there's someone I'm playing that I definitely am like, okay, they're definitely teetering on the edge of like being able to keep their stuff together, I would like go sit at their table and order a pizza.
Oh.
And then be eating pizza while I was bowling. And meanwhile, they're like, you know, they have a hand wiping routine before they go to each thing, and they dry their hands before they do. And it's like, this guy's like, I'm like loudly chewing pizza. Like, ah, man, how are you doing? Like, it's been a minute. It's been months since I've bowled. Like, what have you been up to, man? And you know, the right people would just be like, I'm good. And then would just be fully.
What's the biggest like sportsmanship faux pas in bowling? Is it that? Is it, you know,
what do you mean?
Eating like, while you're bowling? Is it talking to other people? Is it coughing when someone's ready to bowl? What is it? Like the worst thing you could do?
Oh, the worst thing you could do. I mean, purposefully making noise while someone is throwing the ball, whether it's a cough or a yell or something like that. Like that would be a big no-no. Like that's never even a thing that happens.
I remember you definitely don't bowl when the other person next to you is
you
bowling.
Also do not do that. Yeah, that's a common one. Making
that
sure
really can mess you up.
You have, you know, you're taking turns. And then anything else, it's just like, you know, being a good sport. Like there were people who, I don't think I ever did this. I might have did this once or twice when I was younger. I tried not to, but like there were other bowlers I definitely saw it happen with who like, you know, they would miss a thing and they would like kick the ball return or something like that. And like, you know, no, yeah, just be a good sport. Don't throw a fit. Like, don't act like a jackass. But yeah, in terms of faux pas, I think probably purposefully, like, you know, like when someone's throwing would be a big no-no. Like that would be really bad.
So how much do you bowl today? And is it weird not bowling competitively? Or do you still, even when you're just having a good time with friends, find yourself being like, well, I got to win?
In terms of, you know, not counting right now because we're in Massachusetts, I'll probably bowl once or twice every 2 weeks. You know, maybe a week will go by and then we'll go bowling, or sometime will go by. But, you know, I try to get in there every now and then. And sometimes it's just by myself because I really just do enjoy throwing the ball. When I go with friends, it's so funny because my friends are always like, oh, I don't want to go bowling with you. Like, or, you know, when we do go bowling, everyone's like, oh, everyone's going to, you know, everyone try to beat Jack. And it's just like, that's. I'm going to sound like a major douchebag.
I like all your friends are the Hulk, by the way.
Everybody's the Hulk. Everybody's bigger than me and like large.
I feel very comfortable around these guys. No one's ever going to beat me up.
For me, I love bowling with my friends. And I'm just sort of like, you're not going to. We're bowling next to each other. We're not bowling against each other because that's not fun for anybody. My friends who bowl, like my little brother is all my little brother's very good. And so when I go with my brother, we'll frequently beat each other. Like he's very, very good. And we'll do a thing where like the winner of the previous game gets to choose both of our names on the how they appear.
Fun.
So it'll start Jack and Sam, and then like, you know, and then like game two, like, you know, he'll win, and game two, you know, he'll be Magnum and I'll be like Peen or something horrible.
Up there for everyone to see. That's the other thing about bowling nowadays. Like the old score sheets, you could be private with your game. If you had an off game, you know, that was your business. Now it's everyone's business. You know, it's all up there for the whole alley to check out your abilities.
Everybody's
and
looking like, oh no, Peen had a rough game. That's not too good. Like,
what is it like in the bowling community at large? What is the opinion or initiative to get bowling into the Olympics? You know, you have like curling, you have these other sports that are akin to bowling, but bowling, it made the final eight list. I think it was last year, but it's still not in. So what does the community think about that?
I mean, as someone who's definitely, as of right now, very out of touch with like the bowling community, because it's just not where I've been spending my time, that's where my answer is coming from. I would say, yeah, I mean, it should totally be an Olympic sport. Like,
it's
absolutely
kind of weird. It's not,
sport.
If you think about it, like for the things they've let in that are like bowling, even like archery is kind of like bowling. You know, you have something, you shoot it, you know, it
Golf
seems
is like bowling
needs to be. So are people fanatical about getting it into the Olympics in the bowling community?
I would imagine so, but like, I think it's probably either quietly or I just haven't met the get the bowling into the Olympics people who are like, you know, really rabid about it. Like that's I've not had those conversations, but yeah. I mean, it's always been just sort of like a general, yeah, it should be in the Olympics. 100%.
Yeah.
Okay. Picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Jack, my favorite thing about this podcast is learning why. Like, you love it. You loved it from a young age, and you still enjoy, even today, I honestly thought you were going to say casually that you go like once a month or something. The fact that you go like once or twice, like every other week kind of thing is, that's, you're into it. And then you even go alone. So what is it like, what, when you find yourself wanting to go alone, is it because you just, does it make you feel good? Does it put you in a good mindset? Is it something that reminds you of childhood? What is it that sort of, you think, you know, what's the driving force of this, this passion of yours?
That's a great question. And I think there's probably a bunch of answers.
Right.
Because there's so many things I love about it. I mean, like the bowling alley that I go to when I'm home is the bowling alley that I like grew up going to. So to the point that I still know a lot of the staff there, and you know, and sometimes have bowled against them in tournaments. I'm like, you know, so I know people there, and there's a sense of like, I don't know, it's that place, like I grew up going there. Like it's just a nice place to be. The pizza slaps. It's really good. Their Coke Icies are just so perfect. So, and I'm used to bowling there, so I bowl better there than other places. And then in terms of like
cheers, it's where everybody knows your name.
Yeah. And then in terms of just actually bowling, I don't know. It's whether it's with friends or whether it's by myself. I think there's almost something therapeutic about it for me. Just there's like, I mean, cause obviously there's a lot of repetition. It's a sport that you definitely, you can zone in and you can really like get minute with the details and where you're putting the ball, where you're aiming and how you're adjusting and all this. But you also don't, but you also can like just go throw the ball down the lane. Like it does both. Like you can grab a beer and some pizza and huck some balls down the lane, have a good old time. Or you can be like, I'm going to try to beat my high series. I'm going to try to, you know, do that. And then there's a part of me that's like, I like being good at stuff and it's something I know I'm good at. And so like having a good day and be like, you know, you can sort of be like, yeah, I'm good at stuff. Like just being able to
it makes
sort
you feel good
that.
To do something well, you know what I mean? And yeah. And it's funny, I grew up swimming and every time we'd show up to a swim meet, we'd be like, is this a fast pool or a slow pool? Like, and a pool's a pool, but every athlete has their perception of, you know, if it's fast or a slow, you know, situation. Is that true with bowling? You kind of mentioned like the way the lanes are oiled. Are there such things as like fast alleys where like you can really chuck the ball at a higher speed, and slow alleys where you feel like somehow the lane isn't like surfaced correctly?
Absolutely.
Does that exist?
Oh, 100%. And I mean, this gets ticky tacky. Like there's, that's one of the interesting things about bowling is the way that the lanes are oiled. It's every bowling alley is different. And the most broad version of it, there'll be two types of what are called shots, which is basically just how the lane is oiled.
there's a house shot and there's a sport shot. A house shot is like what you experience like 100% of the time. Anytime you go bowling with friends, anytime you're ever in a bowling alley, you are probably bowling on a house shot. And basically that'll mean like it's really oily in the middle of the lane and it's drier on the sides of the lane. So that if you have any sort of rotation on your ball, it's going to sort of naturally keep it out of the gutter. If you throw it and it floats out to the right side, that little curve will bring it back in. If you're if you're spinning it and it's in the middle, it'll keep slipping and it'll stay in the middle. It's sort of there's a much wider margin for error on a house shot, and that's, you know, people want to be good at stuff, and the bowling alley wants you to have a good time. So house shot is what you're going to experience 99.9% of the time. A sport shot is what is used in PBA events and tournaments and stuff like that. And it's so much harder. It's like, I feel if you watch bowling on TV ever, which I don't, I cannot stand to watch bowling. I find it very boring. Like I like to play golf. So which by the way, I'm terrible at golf, but I like to play golf sometimes. I could never watch golf on TV. That's not my thing.
Did a coach ever say like, you got to watch a game, just this guy, see this guy, and you're like, all right. And then you're like, oh God, no, like I have to play.
Yeah, no one ever told me to watch a game because there wasn't really anybody for me to emulate because I throw the ball so wonky. it's not even just like throw two hands. It's like there's like a skip and a hop and it's like it's kind of violent. Like it's ping pong.
It's a bowling ball, 15-pound ping pong. Hey, what's your favorite bowling sensory element? Like, is it the smell, the sound, when you walk into a bowling alley?
It's definitely the sound for me. It's like there's, yeah. And I used to do this horrible thing in high school who am I kidding? I still do it. I would do it in tournaments though. That's what was not great. I had practiced, I'd really, you know, memorized my throw and what it looks like and how long it takes the ball to get to the pins. And I mean, I've been doing it long enough that generally, at least on a house shot, which is easier, literally the second the ball comes out of my hand and touches the lane, I could tell you whether or not it's going to be a strike. I'll be like, oh, yep, that's good. Or like, oh, that came out wrong. That's not a strike. It's like, I generally have a good sense of where the ball's going. And I got really good at timing when the ball was going to like, when the ball was going to hit the pins. And what I would do is I would like throw the ball and just walk off and not look at it. And in tournaments, I would do that. I would throw it and I would instantly walk off and I would like make eye contact with the person I was bowling against and be like when it, you know, do a little crotch chop when I knew it was going to hit the pins. And so you get that motion with, and it's like, you know, most people were like, what the hell is this guy doing? But every now and then that would really screw up my opponent. They'd be like, oh my God. Like
he's not even watching for the end.
Yeah. Like who is this guy? Like
he's a magician. Well, it's the theater of it. That's why, I mean, that's the actor in you who's just like, let's make a show. You know what I mean? Who doesn't love a good touchdown dance? Who doesn't love a good, you know, bat flip. I mean, it's a great, great part of indeed the sport. So those were your moments.
It's like you were bowling with a blind landing there.
Yes. Kingpin or Big Lebowski?
Big Lebowski. And it's been years and years and years and years since I've seen Kingpin. I need to watch it again. But I mean, it's hard just not to say Big Lebowski because it's the Big Lebowski. But those scenes at the bowling alley, man, like to a degree, like that is... Those are the characters that you find in a bowling alley. Like the people who like bowling, this is my thing. Like you have like the dudes and you have the John Goodman character, like you and Donnie, like you have everybody, all of those people exist in real life and are people that you will see if you go to a bowling alley, like a Tuesday night, you know, a Tuesday night advanced league, everybody's really good. And, you know, everybody's pissed that they're not, you know, that you can't smoke inside anymore. And like, which is hilarious because, like, you know, if it's an old bowling alley, the ashtrays are like built into the equipment, which is hilarious. But yeah, no, all of those people are real. And I mean, it's impossible to not just love. I mean, I love John Goodman and the Big Lebowski so freaking much. It's so funny. So yes, The Big Lebowski.
Isn't it funny when you watch a movie like that and you're in the sport, you know, that you realize the stereotypes stereotypes exist for a reason because they are true, you know? It's really true. Okay, one more question I have is, you know, I'm a novice bowler, so I obviously bowl with the bowling balls that are provided by the alley. And I always have my thumb in the hole. Where do you put your thumb? What are you doing with your thumb if it's not going in a hole?
It just sits on the ball like my other fingers. So it's like if these go in, it's just here.
So you're just like, okay. So it's just like out, it's cradling in a way.
Mm-hmm. It's cradling, exactly. Because the way that I turn the ball, I tried it with my thumb, like when I with my thumb in the hole as when I was younger and almost broke my thumb. It was like, oh, it's like the way I
because flipped the thumb, it the way
like
I
didn't
learned.
Come off my thumb. And I was like,
okay. Yeah, because the way I learned to bowl is wherever your thumb is pointing is where the ball is going, which was just my, you know, the way my uncle and my dad taught me.
No, that makes sense. I've never heard that. Totally makes sense.
Yeah. So if the thumb, but then if the thumb is outside the ball, I wonder if that still holds true. If it's more the center of gravity is now more like around the middle fingers, the palm,
the middle fingers here. and the palm of the hand, I think. Okay. If your thumb's way out here.
Yeah.
And yeah, it doesn't, because of the way I throw it, like the ball doesn't roll straight off my hand. It comes off like.
Your bowling balls only have two holes in them.
My most recent bowling ball, the most recent one I bought only has two holes. All the other ones like I've had for years and years and years.
Yeah.
So if I were to go bowl in a tournament right now, I would only be able to use one ball. And like, I really use two. Like I have a strike ball and a spare ball. My spare ball is the 11 pound ball that I used when I was really, really little. It's super old and it doesn't have a weight in it. So I can
just throw
straight.
That now. You just throw that overhand.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I shot at it. Yeah.
Do you name any of these balls?
Well, see, the thing is, I don't, because they're already named. Like by the companies. Like each one is a different model.
Oh,
but it's not,
but
like
you didn't,
you
give
know,
them like Lisa and Charlene and Penelope.
My smallest, my oldest one, which is the 11 pound one, I thought it was really, you could engrave something if you wanted, and I was like, oh, I'm gonna put my name on it. And so it's just like little, the finger holes are tiny and it's so light, and this in teeny teeny like laser engraving just says Jack. So maybe you could say my oldest bowling ball is named after me, but that sounds kind of douchey. So
you're throwing yourself. Let's talk about that.
It's a metaphor.
So I always like to end, we like to end with a love letter to bowling. And speaking of love, though, was there ever like a girl that you impressed before we were done? Like, was there ever a girl who was like, Jack, I love how you handle that ball? Did this help, hurt, or was it neutral to your high school game and current game?
Well, I don't know anything about current game because I'm stuck in a closet doing a podcast, but God, that's a good question. I mean, I think most people probably thought it was like, you bowl? Like, okay. Like, I guess that's not a red flag, but like, I have questions. Like, and then, yeah, people, it, yeah. Anytime I will say there were one or two young ladies who I bowled against in different leagues who were like really good, and I was like, wow, and you kicked my ass in bowling. Damn. And of course that, you know, that never went anywhere, but for me I was like, wow, you're good at bowling. Like, I don't even, wow, that's
You're put in your place.
Yeah.
So here you go, Jack. Dear bowling, what would you say to bowling if you could just speak a love letter to it, and how it's done to your life? What has it done in a positive way?
Oh, geez. Yeah. I mean, dear bowling, like you have been there for me for quite a long time. You bring me peace sometimes, and other times you maybe want to tear my hair out. So we really cover the spectrum with the feelings that I get from you, oh bowling. It's always a place that a good, clean, not shitty bowling alley. It's like always a place where like we'll sort of feel kind of like home, just very comfortable. And like there's sort of a sense of like, you know, the shoulders relax and you walk in, you're just like, ah, yeah.
Yep. Thank you. Well, this I feel my shoulders are relaxed. After this
wonderful I know podcast. When you said that, I was like, oh, I need to relax my shoulders too.
So, Claire, I just kept thinking about you the entire conversation because I was just thinking, like, how competitive do you get when you're bowling? Because I know you're competitive.
I mean, I never played on a league, but definitely friends, family, birthday party, anytime I'm in a bowling alley, it's very competitive because I like to win. And I don't like to lose, David. That's the other side of liking to win, is you also don't like to lose. So absolutely, very competitive. Now as we mentioned in the podcast, now it's all done electronically. I feel like it's a little bit of like the fun is lost in like manually, like, you know, shading in that little square and like putting the line through. And, you know, there's a little bit of the art of bowling that's been lost now that it all is electronically figured. But the other side of that is now your score is projected for the entire alley to see. So if you have a bad game, it's you know, broadcast for the world in the bowling alley.
Claire, have you ever been to Montrose, that little cute little strip in Montrose where there's this little bowling alley? I have rented out a 8-lane bowling alley twice in my adult years just to have a private party. It was not that very expensive. I think maybe the whole thing cost me. I think one time I literally paid like, I think $150 to rent out this little 8-lane alley. You should do it for your kids. But they have the old projector. It was the bowling alley from the movie Pleasantville.
Oh my gosh. No, I have not been there. There was one bowling alley in New York City that we used to go to, which was on the third floor, like somewhere around 18th and like 5th or 6th, kind of forgetting now. It's been several years. And then, of course, in LA, we have Lucky Strike and we have, you know, Jerry's, and then Corbin Bowl, which is out in Woodland Hills type area. Mm-hmm. But no, I have to go to this alley. That sounds great.
And it's projectors. It's like old-timey projectors. And so you write it on like cellophane, your scores. Ooh. And then it like takes, you know, it looks down at the cellophane and then reverse projectors.
It's like the overhead they used in school.
Exactly.
Before. Exactly. You knew when they pulled down that screen that there was going to be a rolling cart coming in with like the overhead projector.
Yeah. But love I definitely that. Remember growing up, I was in a bowling league and it was probably like 15 years old at the time. And I was me and my buddy were in the league and we always had a third. And the third guy was always some rando they gave us. And so this kid was an interesting guy and he got so excited one day and he like that I think he bowled maybe he came back and he bowled a strike and he like put his both of his arms out wide like a airplane and just was so excited like yeah, and he smacked me right in the nose and I got a bloody nose and I'll never forget it. And I still enjoyed bowling, but That is my lame bowling story compared to Jack's wonderful demolishing everyone.
It's still a good bowling story. It's still a good story. You know, I enjoyed hearing about all the additional add-ons, I would call them, from just the traditional ball and shoes, which is all the equipment I have ever. But I was reminded that I really like to dry my hands on the air.
Oh yeah,
on the air dryer before each time, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like I feel like that's really important. And I also realize I bowl with a light ball. I like to bowl with like a 10-pound ball. What about you?
I think the ball that I have back in my home in suburban New Jersey, I think it was like 14 pounds.
Mm.
Yeah. I say that and I'm like, how did I lift that? But I think that's what I have.
If I was going to pursue a career in bowling, which, listen, let's face it, if you're going to pursue a career in bowling, you can do it in any decade. So I feel like I could still, you know, enter into the bowling world if I wanted to, you know.
Girl, never give up. Never give up.
It could happen,
never
David.
Never too late.
And guess what? If it is made an Olympic sport, maybe I will, because I do want to be in the Olympics one day. I've narrowed that down to archery, curling, and then possibly bowling, because those are like things you don't have to necessarily be at peak physical condition to do. You know, I mean, yes, you need to master the skill of each of those things. I'm working on archery right now. I've practiced curling.
I will cheer you on. I will cheer you on. And if you guys want to cheer us on, we love, by the way, if you don't mind, rating and subscribing and all the lovely things. We love hearing from you both in stars and clicks and comments and mentions and all the things. So any way you want to get in touch with us, we appreciate it. And thanks always for listening and coming down the lane with us. Memory lane, if you will.
I'm on pins and needles hearing what you say next.
Yes. All right, and before you go, well, we're done with Dexter, right, guys? Actually, not quite, because we have on the man himself, Kurt Caldwell, yes, Clancy Brown, from Highlander, from Shawshank Redemption, and of course, Mr. Krabs and Dexter Newblood. You just saw him for all those episodes, and he's with us next episode with his love of the Cincinnati Reds, guys. Step up to the plate. We got Clancy Brown. Let's keep this Dexter thing going, because we're going back to Thursdays. See you then.
Thank you for listening to Fanatics, a Roddenberry podcast. For more episodes and info, head over to wearefanatics.com or tweet your Fanatics thoughts and stories at wearefanatics.
Yes, that's We Are Fanadicts. Our show is hosted by Claire Kramer and me, David Magadoff.
Produced by me, Claire Kramer, and Kelsey Goldberg. Executive producers Trevor Roth and Rod Roddenberry.
Our sound engineer and editor is Elizabeth Joy Windham. And you can thank Stephen Mudd for our theme song.
Catch us next Thursday for another Fanatics episode.
Hey, Jack likes to toss big balls down the lane. Crack of those pins. Hey, that ain't a shame, causing Dexter heads are rolling. In real life, Jack likes bowling. That guy ain't no turkey.
Enhance your listening experience with Wondery Plus. Enjoy ad-free listening, exclusive content, binges, and more. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.